Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on multiple systems, on delivering your product or service, the more margin you have and the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, HR into one platform with one source of truth. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required, accessed from anywhere. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified business management suite. And you're improving efficiency by bringing all your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move. So do the math. See how you'll profit with NetSuite.
Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/stereo. netsuite.com/stereo.
Oh, it's such a clutch pickup, Dave.
I know, right? I was worried we'd bring back the same team.
Oh, no, I meant those blackout motorized shades. MVP of the room.
Blinds.com made it crazy affordable to replace our old blinds.
Hard to install?
No, it's easy. Even you could do it.
Nice.
I installed these and then got some for my mom, too.
What, you fly across the country to do the install?
Nope. Blinds.com can do it all. All she had to do was pick what she wanted. She talked to a design consultant for free and scheduled a professional measure and install.
Look at you, a Hall of Fame son.
Oh, I just picked the winning team. They're the number one online retailer of custom window coverings in the world.
Oh, Blinds.com is the GOAT.
The GOAT.
He shoots. He scores.
Go to Blinds.com for up to 45% off and a 100% satisfaction guarantee. Go right now for up to 45% off at Blinds.com. Blinds.com. Rules and restrictions may apply.
History isn't just a bunch of names and dates and facts. It's the collection of all the stories throughout human history that explain how and why we got here. Welcome to the History Unplugged podcast, where we look at the forgotten, neglected, strange, and even counterfactual stories that made our world what it is. I'm your host, Scott Rank. The most famous large-scale sea rescue in history is the Dunkirk evacuation. This was when nearly 400,000 British soldiers were surrounded by the German army in 1940 on the coast of France, and Winston Churchill said, "The whole root and core and brain of the British army had been stranded in Dunkirk and seemed about to perish or be captured." But they were rescued off the coast between May 26 and June 4th in an improvised fleet. But even though this is the most well-known large-scale sea rescue, it's not the biggest. There was actually a larger rescue that happened in America, and it happened immediately after September 11th. At 10:45 a.m. Eastern Time, on Tuesday, September 11, 2001, the U.S. Coast Guard issued the call for, quote, "all available boats," unquote, to assist the evacuation of Lower Manhattan. But hours before the official call went out, tugs, ferries, dinner boats, and other vessels had already raced to the rescue from points all across the port of New York, New Jersey. In less than 9 hours, approximately 800 mariners aboard 150 vessels transported nearly 500,000 people from Manhattan. This was the largest maritime evacuation in history, even larger than Dunkirk, and they did in 9 hours, what took 9 days there. But the story of this effort hasn't been fully told. Today's guest, Jessica DuLong, author of the book Saved at the Seawall, Stories from the September 11th Boat Lift, tells a story on the 20th anniversary of 9/11. She discusses how the New York Harbor maritime community delivered stranded commuters, residents, and visitors out of harm's way after the 9/11 World Trade Center attacks. DuLong herself is the chief engineer emerita of the retired 1931 New York City fireboat John J. Harvey. She served at Ground Zero, spending 4 days supplying Hudson River water to fight the fires at the World Trade Center. To tell the story of this maritime rescue, DuLong drew on her own experiences, as well as eyewitness accounts to weave together the personal stories of people rescued that day with those of the mariners who saved them. One thing she notes during our discussion is that still today, few people recognize the significance of the evacuation effort that unfolded on that landmark day. She describes why this remarkable rescue came to pass, what made the boat lift necessary, what made it possible, and why it was successful. So I hope you enjoyed this discussion with Jessica DuLong. Jessica, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm really excited to talk with you.
This is a unique episode. Usually we don't get into the 21st century, but this is a special event with the 20th anniversary of 9/11. And as you mentioned in your book, and is the case for me and many others, I had no idea about this evacuation. So let's start off with the inner workings of New York Harbor. You are a chief engineer emerita of the 1931 fireboat John J. Harvey. So what is that boat? What was that experience like? And maybe you can use that as a seg into the inner workings of New York Harbor in general.
Sure. So I started out my marine engineering career completely accidentally. There was no plan. There was no, I had not grown up on boats. There are a lot of people who, you know, were born and raised and sort of destined to be boaters. And that was not me. My dad works as a mechanic, a car mechanic. And so the appreciation for fixing things and the appreciation for craftsmanship has been steeped in me since I was born. So what happened was I was working as a dot-commer right at the height of the bubble. I was working in the Empire State Building, and my tiny little startup company was renting office space from this guy named David, who invited me one day, come down, come out to the fireboat. We're going on a leaf peeping trip. And I didn't know what a leaf peeping trip was, and I didn't know what a fireboat was. And I said, no. And so, and then the next offer came very quickly after I had just lost just weeks and weeks and weeks of work building this website. And it was just sort of in a flash, it all disappeared. And I was feeling very raw about the intangible nature of my work when David said, come down, we're having our first volunteer day, come down and get dirty. And that was the magic thing I needed to hear. I did go down for that volunteer day, and I ended up perched on top of this massive diesel engine, cutting out some unused heating pipe with a Sawzall, which is something I'd seen used. In fact, my dad used to use the Sawzall to cut off the top of the pumpkin for jack-o'-lantern carving. So I had a context for it. And, you know, I don't think I had a full appreciation for what this tool was because, hey, you know, if it's for pumpkin carving, what could go wrong? But I did. I ended up, you know, cutting out this pipe, and it was so satisfying. It was just so tangible and hands-on. And I was in this complex maze of equipment in the engine room of fireboat John J. Harvey, which being built in 1931 is just a pinnacle of craftsmanship. I mean, it really is just a stunning example of the way we used to build things in this country. And it was just, I couldn't even begin to understand what was happening down there. And that's what really got me. And then when I was invited to try my hand as an engineer, I told the captain, I said, look, I don't know anything. And he said, don't worry about it. A trained monkey could do it. And because I didn't know that he was lying, I said, yes. And so that started what ended up being a 2 decades long career. And I ended up doing an apprenticeship and working for many, many years, learning all the intricate systems on the boat, learning a lot about, it's a DC powered boat. You know, this is not a common technology for today that's used very widely. And so I was learning about this antique technology and did this apprenticeship basically and ended up working my last 11 years as the chief engineer. So, you know, responsible for the entire operations of the vessel and maintenance and upkeep. And that opened my eyes to New York Harbor and to the Hudson River. But to be clear, my job as engineer requires me to stay in the engine room the whole time we're underway. Because the engineer is actually moving the levers that control the propellers that are controlling the boat's movement through the water. So the pilot is actually communicating, it's a bell boat, and the pilot is actually just saying, hey, I'd like to go this fast on this side in this direction. And then the engineer actually enacts the changes that control the output of each of the generators that are powering the propeller motors, to make it very simple. So what that meant was I was underwater the whole time we were underway, technically speaking, you know, looking out through portholes. And I had this porthole view of Manhattan and all of New York Harbor. And because I had just moved to New York City just a short time prior, I really didn't understand the geography or anything. And I think that's what got me so, so fascinated to understand the Hudson River, which is down in the New York City area. It's called the North River, a relic of days of yore. And that's what got me so curious and led me to write my first book, which is called My River Chronicles, Rediscovering the Work That Built America. And it's all about craftsmanship and the rise and fall of respect for hands-on work in this country. So I studied researched the history of New York Harbor, and that having pictures in my mind of what once was, carries through to this day, so that I have a different perspective on what we see now. Now that the working waterfront is barely anything left of the working waterfront on the shores of Manhattan, because everything's moved to New Jersey and Brooklyn and elsewhere. So that's a quick segue into what was happening. What can I tell you about what's happening now?
Well, I think at least at that time, in the context of 20 years ago, I wonder what people were thinking about a hypothetical evacuation. Now, we have the historical example of Dunkirk, and there might be a lot of parallels with that and a planned evacuation of Manhattan Island, where you have a narrow body of water in the English case, English Channel. And for people who don't know about Dunkirk, it was in 1940 when the British Army was on the continent. They were completely surrounded by the German Army in World War II. Had they surrendered, that could have very well knocked Britain out of the war, if not severely crippled it. But by a mass evacuation with an armada of commercial private vessels, the army was successfully brought back to England, and they were able to stay in the war and maintain its presence. In terms of New York, what was the discussion there in the harbor community of if something like this were necessary, how it would be done? Was such a hypothesis taken seriously? Were there contingency plans for it? What were people thinking?
That's what is so remarkable about this evacuation that ended up becoming the largest maritime evacuation in history, the biggest boat lift, bigger than Dunkirk, was that there was no plan. There was no plan. This had not been envisioned ahead of time. There really was no concept even that were some disaster to happen at the World Trade Center, there was no concept that the towers would actually fall. There was an advertising campaign when the World Trade Center towers were being built. The owners of the Empire State Building were a little bit distressed about no longer having that position of prominence. And so they took out this big ad that basically said, like, what if a plane hits the towers? They could fall. And so there was this, response ad and publicity campaign to say, like, these towers have been built strong enough to withstand the blow of, and it was the largest airplane at the time. And so that was the extent to which anybody conceived of anything even remotely like this. So what that means, practically speaking, is that there absolutely was zero plan for any evacuation of Manhattan. There was zero plan for what could happen, for the towers falling. There was no plan at all. And how this shook out was just absolutely, truly remarkable. And I'd love to draw the contrast between what happened in Dunkirk and what happened in New York Harbor. Because there was no plan, what this meant was that mariners of their own accord, individual captains, pilots, crews on vessels of all kinds, made the decision to jump in and to pull people off the island. That's just what happened over and over again. And individuals made that decision. There was some conversations that happened early on over the marine radio to say, hey, if you're going here, I'll go there. But it just, the effort just magnified, accelerated. And not until 10:45 in the morning. So if you have the timeline, you're looking at the first flight crashing into One World Trade Center at 8:46, right? So this, the disaster starts well before this. Not until 10:45 in the morning did the Coast Guard actually get involved in a real way and say, hey, if you'd like to help with the evacuation, report to Governor's Island. So what they did have in terms of planning was the, and this, let's see, then Lieutenant, now he, I think he retired as Captain Mike Day, was the Coast Guard officer who actually issued that call on the radio at 10:45. And he took with him plans that had been used for op sales. So Operation Sail is this, it's pageantry, right? It's a lot of military vessels that come into New York Harbor, which meant that there were military personnel embarking and disembarking in strange locations. And, you know, there was a whole wide array of vessels that normally aren't in the harbor. So there was a plan that had been put together for that, for like a show. Right? So for the logistics of a show, that is what then Lieutenant Mike Day had at his disposal to draw upon, which had, you know, they had the nautical charts. They knew, you know, what boats draw what, which means how deep the boat, how much water the boat needs to have beneath it to not run aground, right? That's called, you know, a tugboat drawing 9 feet at the bow or something like that. So they had the depths of different places. They had, you know, where there are safe places to dock boats and places that are not safe. But all these different boats had different configurations. Some were ferries. They were designed for loading and unloading passengers. And those ferry captains, they were the first to jump in because this is what they do. They move people. And even at the earliest minutes after the first plane hit, even if that had been what many people believed it was, which was a small plane hitting the tower and an accident, already within the first minute, there were New York Waterway ferries that knew that that meant that there would be transportation disruptions. So they knew that they would be going online and, you know, doing a lot more work that day, moving passengers, even if it hadn't been a terrorist attack. So they were the first to jump in, but then as the morning proceeded, you had every kind of vessel you can imagine, Army Corps of Engineer boats, tugboats, which have no business and no infrastructure for moving passengers. You had sailing yacht vessels, you know, like a yacht is not well designed to come up along the seawall and evacuate passengers. And in fact, I tell some stories about a captain having to make hard decisions about how he could participate. There were fishing boats that came in from on Long Island. There were just little runabouts, a little whale boat, everything that could float, that could move people, jumped in. And so it was entirely unplanned. It was totally spontaneous. It was completely improvised. And it was not a top-down operation by any means. And just to finish up on this, the remarkable decision that the Coast Guard leadership made in that moment was to not come in and take over, but to come in and facilitate the evacuation that was already underway, because it was incredibly successful. It was working. And these mariners, they knew their vessels. They knew the harbor. If they needed information, the Coast Guard and the Sandy Hook pilots, who were actually working with the Coast Guard, would give that kind of information. But it was really this not a top-down operation at all, which is a huge decision to have made and really is the reason why it was so successful.
Hey everyone, Scott here. We're going to take a very short break for a word from our sponsors.
Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on multiple systems, on delivering your product or service, the more margin you have and the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, HR into one platform with one source of truth. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required, accessed from anywhere. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified business management suite. And you're improving efficiency by bringing all your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move. So do the math. See how you'll profit with NetSuite.
Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/stereo. netsuite.com/stereo.
Oh, such a clutch pickup, Dave.
I know, right? I was worried we'd bring back the same team.
Oh, no, I meant those blackout motorized shades. MVP of the room.
Blinds.com made it crazy affordable to replace our old blinds.
Hard to install?
No, it's easy. Even you could do it.
Nice.
I installed these and then got some for my mom, too.
What, you fly across the country to do the install?
Nope. Blinds.com can do it all. All she had to do was pick what she wanted. She talked to a design consultant for free and scheduled a professional measure and install.
Look at you, a Hall of Fame son.
Oh, I just picked the winning team. They're the number one online retailer of custom window coverings in the world.
Oh, Blinds.com is the GOAT.
The GOAT.
He shoots. He scores.
Go to Blinds.com for up to 45% off and a 100% satisfaction guarantee. Go right now for up to 45% off at Blinds.com. Blinds.com. Rules and restrictions may apply.
When it comes to weight loss, no two people are the same. That's why Noom builds personalized plans based on your unique psychology and biology. Take Brittany. After years of unsustainable diets, Noom helped her lose 20 pounds and keep it off.
I was definitely in a yo-yo cycle for years of just losing weight, gaining weight, and it was exhausting.
And Stephanie. She's a former D1 athlete who knew she couldn't out-train her diet, and she lost 38 pounds.
My relationship to food before Noom was never consistent.
And Evan, he can't stand salads, but he still lost 50 pounds with Noom.
I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. Even through the pickiness, Noom taught me that building better habits builds a healthier lifestyle. I'm not doing this to get to a number. I'm doing this to feel better.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom users compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
One other macro question before we get into your personal experiences on 9/11 and the next few days afterwards. What did this look like? Were all sorts of vessels coming to whatever harbor most people would disembark? Was it all around it? I mean, my geographical knowledge is a little bit scattered when I think of docks. When they're shown in movies, they're usually John Wick or action movies where people are shooting at each other, and that's where nefarious criminal activity happens. Was it a few specific ports where people are lining up? They hear their boats will pick them up and they're disembarking in New Jersey? Or what does it look like from a large scale?
That's a great question. The first thing to sort of paint the picture in your mind is to think of Manhattan, which sort of has this skinny shape down to a tip, right? The Trade Center is located pretty close to the tip of Manhattan. And even people in New York, even people who are here, even people who fled that morning, if depending on where they were, if they were far enough north, they just ran north. And then even though we didn't know whether this was the beginning of further attacks, and that's the thing that it's really easy to forget about now when there's a known chronology. Like we know that in fact, once the second tower fell, it was a de-escalation of catastrophe rather than an escalation. But there is a ferry captain who runs the Staten Island Ferry, and it's a big orange, it's a huge boat. I'm trying to I don't even know how to explain to people outside of New York, but they've probably seen photographs. It's this huge, bright orange vessel that used to move vehicles as well as people. So you can picture that for scale. And he said, I felt like I was running a big orange target back and forth in the harbor because he thought they were going to get gunned down. Like that was the depth of fear. So in terms of the geography, there were people trapped, literally trapped when the first tower came down, by debris in Manhattan, at the tip of Manhattan. So people ran until they ran out of land and were pressed like 10 people deep at certain areas of Manhattan Island. And Manhattan is an island. That's the other thing that people forget. So if what happened within a minute after the first plane hit, even in the case of an accident, was that transportation options, subways, the PATH train that takes people under the river, from Manhattan to New Jersey. These things were shut down. The bridges and tunnels were quickly shut down. So people were literally trapped in Manhattan, but people on the tip of Manhattan were trapped because there was debris preventing their escape north up the island. So people evacuated in every way that you can think of. All the things that you laid out there, they all happened. Some were actual formal ferry docks, and people would line up sort of later in the day, further north, less in less danger. People lined up for hours and hours to get their turn to take a ferry to get off the island. Others were people at the seawall. And because Manhattan is no longer a working waterfront, this meant that all of the infrastructure that would have made it possible for all kinds of boats to come and pull up safely to shore, that's all been stripped away. It doesn't exist anymore. And so what's happened is that there's been this prettifying phenomenon along the waterfront, so that it's the infrastructure is actually designed for sort of passive viewing of the river rather than engagement. So what that meant for us on Fireboat John J. Harvey was that there was no safe place for us to tie up when we were, it's hard to describe, but essentially North Cove is the nearest marina. So it's the closest waterfront that you can get to adjacent to the Trade Center, very close to where the towers were. And the railing there is designed still to this day with a curve that curves toward you if you're standing on the sidewalk looking out over the river. And that's it. There's just this huge railing. So firefighters from other active duty boats literally had to get torches and cut the railing out so people could get on and off. Harbor Unit NYPD boat, they took their little boat, which is not designed for passengers, but they took their little boat and ripped off the wooden fencing that blocked off railings that was to keep people, quote unquote, safe, right, and away from the water. He ripped them off, systematically went down the row so that people could board more quickly from an area called South Cove. So everything that you can imagine, there was great fear and duress. People jumped into the water, totally underestimating the incredible ripping Hudson River currents, thinking that they could swim to New Jersey, which is a mile away, which is even professional swimmers who train for races. They do have races where there are swimmers who swim and there are like chase boats and it's the currents are intense. And there were so many rescues of individuals who were being swept out to sea. And they were rescued by mariners. Particularly the ferry boats were well suited to be able to you know, handle a man overboard situation with their equipment. It is so amazing to me how few people know this story still. I mean, it was absolutely a phenomenal effort that just really exemplifies the creativity, the improvisation, and the drive to help people in peril that is, I would argue, a part of all of us, and certainly is a well-established like piece of the culture of the fabric of the maritime world, which was actually, you know, it's codified into maritime law to help people if they're in danger. And so that culture spreads far and wide.
When we talk about the lessons and implications, I'm sure one of them, like you just referenced, is not to panic too much because you can create more problems than help in the case of those who jumped into the bay and thought they could swim. Well, let's talk about your individual experiences, because you were working on the John J. Harvey and the fires from the World Trade Center went on for quite a while due to a number of factors. So you had a front row seat to everything going on. Can you tell me what was happening?
Yeah. Yes, it's not the easiest thing for me. So I apologize in advance for that. But it's just the reality. I ended up learning about the boat being at the site and coming over first thing on the 12th. By that point, both towers obviously had come down. There was just this massive column of smoke that had consumed, you know, the whole all of Lower Manhattan, and actually was blowing to where I was, which is in Brooklyn. So that's across water. And I made a phone call to my crewmates and I said, how am I going to get there? There were no bridges open. There were no subways. The only way to get there was by boat. And so my beloved pilot, Bob Lenny, who had served on that boat for many, many years when she was still part of FDNY. And he rejoined the boat when she was in her retirement. So she had this second life as a museum boat, basically, you know, not at all supposed to be at a fire. And we had been told that point blank by the FDNY not long before this happened, that you all are volunteers, this is a civilian vessel, you are not to be reporting to any active fires. And of course, all the rules were changed on that day because the boat actually, the fireboat went to go and did evacuate one boatload of people, about 100, 150 people, and bring them to a pier further north so that they could be have access to safer areas, and then were called back into service. Then Lieutenant, then since retired as Captain Tommy White, he actually called the boat on the radio and said, can you pump water? Do your pumps work? Because when he arrived, he was horrified to see that all of these just completely ashen firefighters just wandering, walking toward the water. There was no firefighting water available. And, you know, the when two massive towers come down, that changes the scale and scope of what's going on. But there were absolute big working fires going on in the surrounding area down there in the immediate term. And then for months, these fires kept burning for 4 months after, especially the underground fires. There was no firefighting water available because the water mains fueling the city collapsed under the buildings collapsed. And also the hydrants were completely overcome with debris, which meant that river water was the only water that was going to be available for land-based firefighters to use to fight these really big, heavy-duty working fires. So Tommy White, who worked for the Marine Division, was able to sort of connect those dots and realize that this was going to be our source of water. And so summoned fireboat John J. Harvey, which is a 1931 boat, really had been told no business fighting fires. And sure enough, her pump still worked and she needed to do this job. And so they were actively pumping when I arrived. I arrived on the 12th, as I said, and I was brought over by a pontoon boat from merchant mariners from the FDNY headquarters in Brooklyn. And coming around that corner and you know, smelling that smell and seeing that smoke, all I knew was that whatever was gonna happen next was gonna change everything. And then as I approached the fireboat that I work on, fireboat John J. Harvey was along the seawall tied up alongside all of these other vessels. There were tugboats tied up. There was just a whole array of mostly work boats and not ferry boats at that point. And I saw that the pumps were working and I just had this moment of my heart just swelling because this was the boat that had already captured my heart and my love. And it was doing the job for which she'd been built so many decades prior. And she was serving her city. And so that was my job in being there was to continue the pumping operations. We actually pumped water consistently from Tuesday until Friday. And then were relieved of duty on Friday afternoon.
I mean, that's amazing that a retired vessel from 1931 is working after it's been decommissioned. I mean, I'm trying to think of an analogy. If someone had a replica of Captain Cook's vessel from the 18th century and was there at Dunkirk ferrying people back and forth. I mean, the boat might have been old, but for the need at hand, it served its purpose perfectly fine. But it sounds like it did its job over those days.
Absolutely. And, you know, this was a boat that was built for emergency service. And it was built, as I said, at a time when American craftsmanship was really at its height. I mean, the redundant systems that were dreamed up, engineered, and constructed into this vessel served the city really well. And, you know, it's old technology, but very, very solid. And this, the deck guns and the piping system for the water that was needed that day, it was all brass and bronze. So unlike, you know, steel pipes that are going to waste away in salt water, which is what the Hudson River is down there, that's why this boat was able to do this job, because she had been built with with this this drive toward things lasting, towards, you know, towards doing the job, doing it well, and for a very long time. And it wouldn't be the same with something built today, unfortunately.
Hey everyone, Scott here. One more brief word from our sponsors.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry, we were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
That 4-day period, it for those who weren't there in the media aftermath of September 11th, I mean, it was absolutely disorienting. And you mentioned this, that we have the benefit of hindsight, but then we didn't know if this was the first of a wave of successive attacks. There, people were guarding critical infrastructure. Anyone in a major metropolitan area may have thought, I better not be downtown because I could be targeted. It's very similar to the immediate aftermath of Pearl Harbor, when many thought that on the West Coast, they could be targeted. There were mandatory blackouts in major cities. And it sounds silly, but I mean, at the time, it made total sense because you simply didn't know what was going to happen. It was prudent to exercise caution. So in that period, when that doubt about what was going to happen next was so intense, what was it like when you were working, when you were putting out fires and there was maritime rescue going on? So yeah, tell me about events that really stuck out to you at that time.
One thing that comes to mind actually happened earlier before I was on site, which I think would be telling for people, because it's really hard to get into our minds what it felt like to be there and the not knowing. There's a story that I follow in the book of a very young woman named Tammy Wiggs, who was working her first She was in like the first few days of her new job. She had just graduated college and she was working on the New York Stock Exchange. And she was new to the city, kind of like me, and new to her job, kind of like me at the time. And the stock exchange floor was evacuated. They didn't open the market. And here she was out on the street corner in a place that she really didn't know very well, just completely confused about what to do next, where to go. And some people said, well, just walk north. Her apartment was north, I think, I can't recall, but someplace uptown. And she was too afraid to walk north because she knew that the Empire State Building was north. She didn't realize how wide Manhattan is and that there are plenty of places you could walk north that's not near the Empire State Building, but she didn't have that her bearings, and she was afraid that that was going to be the next target. So instead of walking north, what she did was she followed the there was a woman who was a real leader on the floor working, had been working for a long time, and you know, was sort of a force of confidence and, okay, this is what I'm going to do. You can join me if you want. And so what she was going to do, her name is Karen Lacey, and she was going to go to a ferry and go to New Jersey because that's where she lived. And she said, you can come with me, Tammy. So the two of them end up walking, and the direction that they end up walking is straight toward the towers. And so there they are walking, and they're, and it's in the immediate aftermath. It's before the first tower comes down, and they're seeing people fall and jump from the towers, and watching that, and Tammy not knowing, you know, she's getting closer and closer to the disaster. And in fact, they were at North Cove, that area that I mentioned, that's the waterfront directly adjacent to the towers. They had just stepped into that area when the first tower came down, and they were completely caught up in the choking dust and ended up both of them jumping into the water because they couldn't breathe. And she talked later, Tammy did, about how, I know it makes no sense, but I couldn't breathe above the water. So I thought maybe I could breathe under the water. And she was a strong swimmer. She was one of the people who said, okay, maybe I can swim to safety and get out of here. Then she realized how quickly the current was pulling her, and the two women were basically clinging to the seawall and ended up getting rescued by firefighters aboard an active duty fireboat that day. So that's a piece of the not knowing and how that can affect you. For myself and my own experience down there, what happened was, I'm trying to paint the picture that basically, because there was no infrastructure along the shoreline, this meant that you had large vessels. Fireboat John J. Harvey is 130 feet long, right? And the other big fireboats at the time, as well as these other big tugboats and other vessels, big, big, big boats, they need a big place to tie up to, right? There were no bollards. There were no landside infrastructure elements to be able to tie to, which meant that we ended up tying to trees, which meant that we are now tying these boats to, you know, sidled up alongside the seawall. And then there are these long, thick ropes that are then across the walkway tied to trees. So what happened was, at a certain point, I was helping to organize supplies on land when, if people recall, it was not until on the 11th, it was not until 5:20 when 7 World Trade Center collapsed, right? So many hours after the previous collapses. So there was this sudden uproar and screaming and running and panicked, just rush to get to the river because there was an announcement that another building was getting ready to collapse. And so I was caught up in that crowd, and I saw a bunch of people get knocked over just in the mayhem of it. And, you know, other people stop and pick them up. And then we're all running to the river. For me, it was like, I need to get to my boat. For them, it was, I need to get away. And all these lines were stretched across the walkway, which meant that all of a sudden the chain of communication goes down, watch the lines, so people didn't fall and trip. And so as many people as could piled onto all the boats, including our boat. I knew my job was in the engine room, so I looked at my chief engineer at the time, Tim Ivory, and he pointed down to the engine room, and I scrambled downstairs and started firing up engines and stood at my spot, and I signaled to the pilot, Bob Lenny, that I was ready. And I just stood there waiting, and a whole bunch of people, you know, had fallen onto the decks of boats and hurt themselves, and there was no collapse. And soon, my chief engineer came down and said, you know, and signaled for me to shut down engines, that we were standing by. But that was the depth of fear. And you know, a firefighter jumped into the water at that moment too, with full turnout gear. The fear and the panic and the not knowing was a huge piece of it. That's hard for people to understand now. And, you know, you, as somebody who appreciates history and the value of knowing our history, even if we weren't there, you know, generation after generation after generation, preserving this memory, I think it's really important to find ways to crystallize and encapsulate that feeling for people who weren't there then.
What do you think made the boat lift successful? Because this was spontaneous, as you described. People in a pinch were hopping on their private vessel if they had one and contributing. When, if you look at other things that happen in history, plans that fail constantly, and Sun Tzu would say, yeah, all plans fail upon contact with the enemy. Mike Tyson said, everyone has a plan until they get punched in the face. maybe there's just something special about boat lifts. I don't know, with Dunkirk and this, but still, I mean, it's remarkable that it happened and moved such a mass of humanity in a short window of time with a cloud of uncertainty happening. So why do you think it succeeded?
You know, I think a big piece of its success is the fact that there was not an attempt to take over by powers that be, right? That's often the people on the ground or in the water in this case know what's going on. And especially in a disaster like September 11th, and I don't know if you've seen and heard this in your reading, and if this is something that people who haven't been immersed in this as I have for decades now know, but the closer you were to what was going on, the less you knew. And so there was a source, a gentleman that I interviewed who didn't realize, even though he was under the rubble of the tower, he did not realize that the tower had collapsed until he got all the way he had been a former Coast Guard officer, and he got all the way to the Coast Guard station at the tip of Manhattan and learned from them that the tower was actually gone, right? So the vantage point that people had from the water was helpful, and there are radio transmissions of fireboat crews trying to give information to the landside firefighters about which floors and which side of the building were inflamed, because if you read or listen to it's really upsetting to do so, but the transmissions that were made by firefighters within the buildings, they didn't know what was going on. They didn't know where the fire was. They didn't know what capacities still remained to be able to fight the fires. I mean, it was awful. So I think the success came from the fact that being a mariner, the professionalism that it requires, the improvisation, that's just a part of the job. It's everything is going just fine until all of a sudden it is absolutely not, and it becomes a life or death situation. That's just kind of what working on boats is like, at least in my experience. Like, everything's fine and really boring and nothing's happening, and then it all hits. And so one thing is that mariners are trained in firefighting. They're trained, licensed mariners, I should say. You get your Coast Guard license. And this requires training in a lot of health and safety and first aid, which was used that day by mariners. There were boat crews who were treating people who had devastating injuries, you know, glass embedded in their body and just absolutely severe burns, clothes melted onto them. And while that's not what's typically envisioned when you take your training classes, there was equipment that they had on board, first aid equipment, and there were skills that they had that they practiced. So the ferry captains or ferry crews, I should say, every month they would do a man overboard drill, which meant that they knew where the infrastructure was in their boat. They knew how to slide the ladder down. They knew how to do it because they had practiced it every month. So that's a piece of it. It's just the professional skill. Another piece of it is that even though it's important to me to emphasize that people made the choice over and over again to turn their boats around and head straight for the smoke, the fire, the, you know, mysterious hell that was unfolding and not knowing what was happening next, they made that choice. If you talk to mariners, there was no choice to be made. It was just a given. It was just, it didn't feel like a choice. It was like, oh, this is what I have to do. I have this boat. These are people who are in trouble. I have the capacity to help, and I help. And I really feel that that the mariners and so many other people who helped that day, that's actually who we are. We vastly underestimate our human potential and really have this limited view of who we are. We divide the world into heroes and all the rest of us. And honestly, I really feel that all of us have that capacity within, that we're all driven by a desire to help other people. And I think that's just what absolutely bloomed and blossomed that day. And that's how this worked.
Looking back 20 years later, what sticks out the most to you from this experience? And what lessons do you hope people take from looking at your book and learning the story of this rescue?
The most important thing for me right now is that we are so divided in this country. We are, and worldwide, but specifically in this country. And we are not seeing each other. We're not listening to each other. and we're not realizing our shared humanity. And this effort was made, no one was asking, you know, who you voted for before you could get on the boat, you know? Everybody was just, it's amazing how, like, if the plane's going down or what's happening, you reach out to the hand of the stranger next to you. And you recognize in that moment that you're in this together. And what we saw in the aftermath of September 11th was exactly that, was that there was this newfound solidarity, this newfound, like, we will move forward. We will do this together. We will take care of each other. We will be patient for each other. We will create space. We will, all of these, very unified messages. And that moment is gone. And I feel that we need to remember that that moment is still possible, that we do have this impulse to help one another, that we can look and see the goodness in each other. And that in the horror of this, the idea, just to think that someone would use a passenger-filled airplane and smash it into a building where there are other people, right? They're using it as a missile. That's unfathomable. And in the face of that, what happened? You saw this absolute groundswell of goodness, of people sacrificing their own well-being to help other people over and over again. That is what we see in the narrative. And it's time for us to focus on that piece of the narrative instead of getting stuck in the horror, because that's who we are when we are at our best. We help each other. We take care of each other. We recognize our shared humanity in moments of crisis. And that's the biggest lesson that I hope people will get from remembering this history.
Well, this is a important contribution to our understanding of the story of September 11th. And for listeners who want to learn more, the book is Saved at the Seawall, Stories from the September 11th Boat Lift. Jessica, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate the opportunity to speak with you and share this critically important history.
Okay, well, that wraps things up for today's episode. Thank you so much for sticking with me to the end. Once again, I want to start things off by thanking the Spymasters of History Unplugged. I'll explain what that is in a second. Our Spymasters include Bill Ivey, Moondoggy from Ohio, Tom from Ohio, Ryan Gillen, Rob from Chicago, Nick Brooks, Michael from New York, Carl from Norway, Josh Reddick, Jennifer French Lee, Jay Carrington, McCrays, Salvador Sanchez, David Santee, Chris C., and Baron Fraser. If you'd like to support the show, there's some very easy ways to do so. First, go to the site halfpricehistory.com. I've worked out an arrangement with a lot of the authors who've appeared on this show, and you can go there and get their books for 50% off. All you have to do is go to halfpricehistory.com and enter the promo code UNPLUGGED at checkout. Second, please leave a review and subscribe to this podcast on your favorite podcast player of choice, whether Apple Podcasts or Spotify or Stitcher or whatever. Third, join our Facebook group. You can go to Facebook and search for History Unplugged. There, you can talk with other fans of the show about recent episodes, what you liked, what you didn't like. Also, I have exclusive content there, such as live streams, where I do live versions of podcast episodes where you can leave feedback as I'm talking, and I will address it on air. Last, and I think this is the best, is to join our membership program, the Knowlton's Rangers. The Knowlton's Rangers were George Washington's spies during the Revolutionary War, but it's also the name of the membership program for History Unplugged. If you go to patreon.com/unplugged, you can join the membership program at three levels. If you join at the Scout level, you'll get all 400 episodes of History Unplugged absolutely ad-free and early access to new episodes. If you join at the second level, the Intelligence Officer level, you get all the stuff that Scouts get, along with bonus episodes. There's currently about 40 of them, including series on Audie Murphy and Operation Long Jump about the Nazi attempt to assassinate FDR, Churchill, and Stalin in 1943. Finally, if you join at the Spymaster level, you'll get a shout-out to you and or your business at the end of each episode. You get a 3-pack of hardcover history books, and you can find out what those are if you go to patreon.com/unplugged. Finally, you can ask me a question about history on absolutely any topic on earth, and I will research it and devote an entire episode to your question. Probably about 30% of the questions in the archive for the show have been based on these sorts of questions. So there you go. Go to patreon.com/unplugged to learn more. All right, well, that is all for today's episode. Thank you so much for listening, and I'll see you next time.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
One of the best works of art about World War I isn't Johnny Got His Gun or 1917, but the Swedish heavy metal band Sabaton's album, The Great War. Here's lead singer Joachim Broder.
From a more general point of view, I feel like our music, from the emotional spectrum, I guess, that's in our music, it's pretty emotionally close to what you'd find on the battlefield or in history. There is obviously the aggression, sometimes a sense of joy and pride, sometimes depression, and all these things.
You can listen to our full interview on the History Unplugged podcast, and you can find it on the podcast player of your choice.